Thank you for downloading this audio recording from InterVarsity Faculty Ministry. You're listening to part two of Faith and Academic Commitments in a Postmodern World. Our speaker is Dr. Alan Paget, Professor of Systematic Theology at Luther Seminary in St. Paul, Minnesota. These talks were recorded on April 19, 2008, at the Wisconsin Faculty Symposium. To learn more about faculty ministry and other upcoming events, please visit www.facultyministry.org. And now, Dr. Alan Paget.
So we were just finishing up the earlier talk. I just really only had two more slides. One of them was a summary, but when I was asked to write the first chapter in a book on how philosophy and theology work together, called For Faith and Clarity, and the book is in the suggested reading page. It's still on the, if you didn't get it, it's still on the registration table. I decided to go back and do a little bit of that sort of Christ in culture thing where you look at different typologies. So I still kind of think this is fun. It worked out nicely. So if you go back in time to the Middle Ages when it comes to how theology and philosophy can mutually interact, you could start all the way back with Tertullian if you wanted to, but I rather like Anselm of Beck, also known as St. Anselm, in the beginnings of scholastic philosophy. He's famous for writing the Monologion and Why Did God Become Human? And anyway, for Anselm, it was clear that it's faith-seeking understanding is one of his slogans. So I put there that theology seeks philosophy for Anselm. You start with faith, you have belief, and then you seek understanding, you seek philosophy as a conversation partner. And Anselm also developed a famous proof for the existence of God that we call the ontological proof. But probably the greatest mind of the Middle Ages, certainly from the point of view of philosophy and religion, is Thomas Aquinas, who wrote the great Summa Theologiae. And for Aquinas, philosophy can serve as a preambula fidei, that is, as a preamble to faith. So Aquinas believed that grace, the grace of God, can perfect and complete our natural gifts, and that philosophy can lead to theology. And that's another way that still today Thomists or Jesuit universities will often have this kind of underlying assumption, I think. Then we got Martin Luther for the view that philosophy and theology are in tension, that they are both good. There's nothing wrong with philosophy, Luther really thought, although he called reason some bad names a few times, but he was a very earthy speaker, that good old German preacher there. But that philosophy and theology are in tension because faith and the world are in tension for Luther's theological setup. Sin and grace are in tension rather than, you know, grace perfecting nature. I think for Luther, the Word of God always comes and has to critique sin and the world. And we already talked about James Orr, who represent that sort of Genevan tradition, if you will, that theology transforms philosophy. Now, as a Methodist thinker, I want to put up here a Methodist theologian. Gordon Parker Bound is not very well known today, but at one time he was a major figure in the United States. He was a philosopher who went and studied in Germany and started a school at Boston University, which originally was a Bible school called, for Methodist pastors, called Boston Theological Institute. And he was there as a professor of theology and philosophy. And as a student of Hegel and other idealists on the continent, he kind of thought that philosophy completed and perfected religion. So, you know, religion and theology are okay at a sort of basic level, but it was philosophy that transformed theology and made it into a rigorous, academic, wissenschaftlich discipline that's worthy of people's respect. And Methodism as a whole, I don't know what you think about this, Victor, but Methodism as a whole has tended to see philosophy as a very important academic partner making theology respectable in the university. And I think that's true today for a number of Methodists. There's a whole school that would disagree with that, but at least there's a stream there that's pretty important. So these are just, I'm not saying one of these is right, wrong, or whatever, but these are different ways in which theology and philosophy have worked together historically, and they're simplifications, but they are definitely there. And of this, if you're going to say, well, which ones do you really like? I think it probably is Anselm. I mean, I really think that faith does seek understanding. Faith seeks integration with other disciplines, including dialogue with science, because of what it is, because it's faith in God the Creator, because of faith that in a God who is the source of truth and who is rational and wants us to know. Of course, knowing it cannot be the end in itself in the Christian religion, because we love our neighbor as ourselves and we have to live out our faith, but knowing is there. Okay, so this is just a summary of the earlier talk, that theology needs philosophical rigor and insight to help the church in its mission. So here we're just transitioning to talking about postmodern philosophy for a little bit. And philosophy, like postmodern philosophy and other philosophies, can help us, even when the people are not believers in any way, or even atheists, they can help us understand the culture and the assumptions that they're in. Philosophy often examines either for or against the context, the language, the world that it's part of, the reality that that culture is embedded in. So it's useful. Philosophy can be a very useful tool for the mission of the church. And again, I argue that theology should engage in the common work we have with all the disciplines, all the arts and sciences, to develop a biblical, rational worldview for today's church. So that against someone like Borden Parker Bowne, I would argue theology and philosophy are not the same thing. I don't want to put them totally in tension, but I don't think philosophy somehow completes theology in some way, but they can be colleagues without becoming the same thing. And that's going to become important when we start thinking about postmodern philosophy. You know, how does the gospel engage postmodern thought? What is postmodern thought? And of course, you know, even asking that question and thinking there is such a thing is already to engage maybe in a problem. So this is just a summary of my earlier talk. And now I want to go on and talk about the other thing that I've got here to discuss, which is postmodernism. I am very interested in the postmodern turn in philosophy. And like I said, in writing the history of the 20th century, philosophy and theology, it just seemed to me that so many streams and currents kept making this postmodern turn. So there's a certain simplification in both the lectures today, but I'm just trying to give us some hooks to hang some of our ideas on and maybe to get engaged in beginning to think about some of these topics. And in the suggestions for further reading, I've listed some beginning introductory postmodern philosophy books that I recommend. And the reason I say that is the unfortunate fact that occasionally you'll get an evangelical scholar who wants to engage postmodern philosophy but hasn't gone to all the hard work of understanding it. And so the engagement, the dialogue, is a little on the superficial level, a little bit sort of without a deeper understanding, you can caricature and sort of label and dismiss different views that are more sophisticated than you might think. So, I put on ones that I think that are still pretty basic, but at least they seem to have grasped some of the point of some of these postmodern thinkers that are so common now in universities. I mean, really doesn't matter what big university you go to in North America. There is the academic world has a postmodern influence on it. And even in departments that, you know, are thinking, oh, postmodern, that's so passe and so silly or whatever, it's nevertheless the case that these ways of thinking have influenced what goes on in those departments, even if it's just them fighting against it. So all I'm trying to do in this shorter talk now, before we have more talk, is just ask, what is this postmodern turn in philosophy? You don't want to say it has some essence or it's an identical school. It's not an ism. We're not talking about, okay, I'm going to give you the five things that always and everywhere define postmodern thought, because that would itself be modernist rather than postmodern, but just some indications of what this attitude is and how shall Christians respond. Because just like, as I said, Soren Kierkegaard was one of the, you know, grandfathers of postmodernity, so there are postmodern Christian philosophers. So it's not like they're antithetical, but generally, how shall evangelical Christians think about this? And when it comes to engaging the postmodern, just like engaging science, I want to take mission as a model. That is, I want to go back to this idea that the gospel is going to encounter culture, learn from it, and also criticize it. One of the things that missions people are saying today, which I firmly believe the church would have been better off to have taught 100 years ago, is that the first thing a missionary does is listen. You know, you have to learn from, respect, and usually come to love the culture that you're a missionary in to be effective for the gospel. So when I say mission as model, I'm not thinking the kind of mission that you do with a conquistador behind you with a big sword. I'm thinking, you know, the kind of more humble listening type of mission where you're trying to learn from but also bring some good news to a situation in the name of Christ. Well, the first thing to unlearn is I don't think the word postmodern has to do with time. And there's a lot of postmodern scholars now who are arguing not only that there's no such thing as ism in postmodernism, because to be an ism, like a Marxism, right, you really need a unified set of beliefs, and there just isn't one. And it's really not a time, because if Kierkegaard and Nietzsche are postmodern, then postmodern happens in the middle of the modern. It's not something that comes after anything else. So it must mean post in a different way than time. And so some of these people say, well, what comes after the postmodern? Well, nothing, in the sense that it's not about time. It's about stance and critique. It's more like a dance step where one person leads and the other person follows, and then they lead again, and they follow again. And it's really not about, you know, one thing dying totally, namely modernity, and another new, totally different thing happening. Because modernity and postmodernity in philosophy are in symbiosis. They feed on each other. They work together. You can have modernity without the postmodern. You cannot have the postmodern without modernity. It just can't exist. It's not its own independent thing. So in order to understand the postmodern, you need to know what is modern. And as a philosophy, modernity is basically some leftovers of the Enlightenment, you might say, including the Romantic movement. There's different kinds of Enlightenment rationalities. But it's some of the extreme positions of the Enlightenment, some of the prejudices of the Enlightenment period, based on a, we want to say, overweening confidence in the human self and the capacities of human reason and insight. And in the Romantic movement, it becomes a celebration of art, a seeking of the sublime, and an immediacy between the soul and the beautiful and the transcendent. And that kind of romantic immediacy is just as problematic for postmodern thinkers as Enlightenment rationalism. Sometimes we forget that. There's more than one kind of modernity. So if you're in music or literature, you know what I mean by the Romantic movement and how powerful that was and still is. But that kind of desire for the immediacy of experience is criticized by Derrida and a host of other philosophers, saying that just, there is no such thing as that kind of direct immediacy with the sublime, the transcendent, or anything real. And finally, it is a critique of any quest for a universal, self-grounding system that sometimes is called meta-narratives. So one French philosopher who came to Canada and gave a report on knowledge called The Postmodern Condition said, simplifying things to extreme, the postmodern is incredulity toward meta-narratives. But what he meant by meta-narrative was not just a grand narrative, big story. You know, and literally in French, you might translate it as, but as a universal, philosophically self-grounding, you know, system of thought that didn't need anything outside of itself because it can encompass all reality and it can ground its own rational principles in reason itself or something like that. That's what a meta-narrative is for Lyotard. So if that's what modernity is, you know, and different scholars will emphasize different things. You know, maybe you've heard the word Derrida doesn't like, it's logocentrism. Okay, so he's going to use that word to describe it. You know, Lyotard says meta-narrative. So they all have their own little word, right, or concept or thing they're going after. And good old John Dewey, we talked about him earlier today, in the 1930s, was critics wrote a whole Gifford lecture on the quest for certainty and was critical of it. But of course he didn't write in French, so it doesn't count. So, but you know, the Dewey is a little bit postmodern too in his rejection of epistemological certainty. So you can be postmodern in the middle of modernity, and I'm going to argue not only can you be, you have to be. There's no such thing as the postmodern without modernity. It exists at the same time and alongside it. Well, one couple, a philosophical duo that I learned from, and it makes this argument, I'm just going to give you a quote from their book, The Postmodern Political Condition. Originally written in French, these people are philosophers from Eastern Europe, and this is kind of a long quote, but I think he's making the same point that I'm making, so therefore it has to be true. Postmodernity may be understood as the private and collective time and space within the wider time and space of modernity. So it takes space here as a metaphor, right? I mean, it's not, but it's a voice, if you will, a perspective that takes place in the midst of modernity. It's a sound that interrupts the smooth flow of modernity's talking to itself. You know, it's like a protest that happens in the midst of other things. It isn't something that, you know, here's modernity, okay, boom, and then next year, boom, postmodernity, like one that happens after it. People who think about that way about the postmodern, at least in the world of philosophy, you know, and the problem with postmodern is it's all over the place. I mean, you got films, you novels, architecture, even some of the buildings here at Wisconsin where you think everything would be square and concrete, thank you very much, are looking a little postmodern to me, including this one. Did you notice the little roundy thing over there and all that? You know, so we are not going to be square. So in architecture has a postmodern phase too. So there's all these different ways of being postmodern. So just to be clear, I'm only talking about philosophy. It's the only thing I'm competent to talk about. I don't know anything about architecture. Are you kidding me? I can barely, you know, make a little treehouse in the backyard for my kid. I can't do architecture. Anyway, so it's a wider time and space of modernity delineated by those who have problems and queries addressed to modernity, by those who want to take it to task, and by those who make an inventory of modernity's achievements as well as its unresolved dilemmas. Postmodernity, thus, can only define itself within this plurality against all those heterogeneous others. Basically, what they're saying, then, is that there are the postmodernist people who respect aspects of Enlightenment culture and philosophy and thinking, whether it's rationalistic or romantic, but are also critical of it. So in the midst of realizing there's some good things, also see that there's critique that must be made on various fronts. So postmodernity, then, to me, is a cultural space. Without the modern, there would be no postmodern. They coexist and feed on each other. So that means the postmodern is not the opposite of modern, not an antithesis in some Hegelian way. And again, time is not really the issue. The question is not what comes after what. What comes after the postmodern? What comes after modernity? The issue is more of a statement and a critique or even a dance. And that's why Kierkegaard and Nietzsche are the prophets of the postmodern philosophy, even though they're in the 19th century. And they represent two types of being postmodern, religious and atheist. Just as in the, I don't know if you guys even remember the 60s, but existentialism used to be really big, you know, and IBP came out with books on existentialism, blah, blah, blah. So there were basically, Sartre himself said there's two kinds of existentialism, religious and atheist. And he's the atheist, okay? So there's two ways of being postmodern, religious and atheistic. And one of the most amazing things that's happening in contemporary French philosophy, anyway, is there's a real turn to the theology and to the theological themes after a long history of atheism. And so people that are total atheists are writing books about Paul, or, you know, God without being, or things like this. So, you know, the people are getting involved in religious themes because these have been raised by postmodern religious thinkers. So Kierkegaard represents sort of that postmodern religious believer, and Nietzsche the atheist. Both SK and Nietzsche were critical of rationalism and great moral systems of philosophy. Of course, for Nietzsche, the new transvaluation of values, the will to power, has to be predicated on the death of God. So he was embraced and preached the death of God. For Kierkegaard, the knight of faith, that's one of his phrases, lives without absolute foundations. So over against Kant or Hegel, Kierkegaard is saying that really the truth that you seek, which is the highest truth being subjective, that is based on faith. It is not based on pure evidence and rationality. It's not based on some great system, but on faith. And faith is not purely rational. So Kierkegaard again makes this famous phrase of the leap of faith. Now, if Steve Evans were here, and he writes for University Press, he's a good philosopher and expert on Kierkegaard, he would point out that in other places, Kierkegaard wants to bring faith and reason together a little bit more. But, you know, in some of his writings, usually ones under pseudonyms, that is that he published in somebody else's name rather than his, in order to give that person a voice that he himself didn't have. Kierkegaard was a very conflicted and complex author. He at no point is he going to say, though, that faith is purely rational. Faith may learn from reason, but it's never going to be based on a purely rational ground. And to this extent, Kierkegaard is the son of Luther. He is a Danish Lutheran philosopher. If we look at the natural sciences, then, and think about this issue of postmodernity, what happens is, on the one hand, we want to say, you know, we want to catalog the benefits of modernity, right? So natural science and technology have been great. We've all benefited from them. We couldn't be in this space doing what we're doing right now without natural science. My father would be dead if it wasn't for modern medicine. I mean, all of us have benefited from science. There's loads of important applications, lots of insight, predictive power, deeper knowledge about the world that come from science. You're waiting for the but, I know you were, but okay. The thing is that science doesn't solve everything. It's caused problems. There's limits to and cracks within a system that tries to be all and only scientific. Because scientific thinking can objectify, can dehumanize, it can become arrogant, it can seek to be value-free when it isn't, and therefore be blind to its own values that make it work. Scientism, in other words, thinking that science will solve all of our problems, that the scientific way is the only way to truth, that science and technology become a kind of substitute religion, scientism is an opponent of Christian faith, actually any religious faith. And this myth of purely scientific neutrality can be detrimental to learning and reasoning and thinking. If you're getting outside of the realm of science, and all you think about is scientific way, you're not going to learn anything. So the postmodern philosophers have tended to be critical of scientific learning, not because they're opposed to science, but because they're opposed to scientism or to some philosophy of life that thinks science is the only right way to think about everything. So I think that's an example of something that's postmodern, where you recognize the value, but you're critical of some of the excesses. So modernity then, as a system, tended to think of science, always with a big S, as the best or only right way to think, the only right way to all truth. And attempted to use the scientific method in many domains. I was walking down the street. Now I value education. I'm an educator. And I had some wonderful friends in Azusa Pacific who taught in the School of Education, and they're great intellectual people. So I'm not putting down education, but I did think it was funny to walk by a building called Education Science. So in other words, to value itself, think about this. They have to call themselves science. See what I'm saying? That's not good. That's actually a put-down, because what it's saying is, I have to make myself into a science in order to value myself. That'd be like my saying, I have to make myself into a ballet dancer in order to value myself. I could try, but you could probably tell by looking at me that it's not going to work. So this idea that science is the only right way into reality, it's everywhere in our culture. Everywhere in our culture. And it undermines any religious claim to truth, moral claim to truth, quests for beauty, all sorts of things that are, I don't want to say different from. I don't want to, like, not value the natural world or the social world, don't get me wrong at all, but it's different from and not amenable to scientific methods. And so, now, not all postmodern people are French. I know the French don't really believe that, but it's true. One of the most important postmodern authors was a philosopher of science called Thomas Kuhn. And we'd already talked about his book, Paradigm Shift, his idea of paradigm shift. Well, in 1970 is the available edition, he published The Structure of Scientific Revolutions, which is he would hate to be called a postmodern, right? But given my definition, that's what it is. It's an analysis of science as a human enterprise that's not purely neutral and value-free, arguing that the natural sciences are not self-grounding or purely rational, and theory choice, paradigm shift, is not based just on data plus good reasoning, but that there's human values, perspectives, and worldviews that enter into these major changes in scientific revolutions. And then, of course, there's lots of times where data plus good reasoning does determine the outcome, but to think it's always like that is a mistake in the philosophy of science. So that was a very powerful book. In fact, I'm told by good authorities that it is the most cited academic book of the 20th century. Period. I'm not saying it's the most read or bought, but it's the most cited. In those, you know how they have these people who get all these indexes and count up how many cites you get. It's the most cited academic book in the second half of the 20th century. That's big. So he made a big, big, big deal there. Well, this is going to be a shorter lecture than the other one. So I've been trying to characterize postmodern philosophy as a critique of the assumptions and arrogance of Enlightenment thinking, having to do with an autonomous transcendental self, like Kant's transcendental ego, having to do with, a self-grounding reason that understands itself, and also having to do with any sense of direct immediacy where the world is just the way I experience it, or I can somehow get an unmediated perspective on reality that isn't grounded in who I am as a person, that isn't embodied and located in my social and physical location. So anything that tries to go outside of our human finite conditions to know the truth in some pure way, it's not mediated by language and symbols and systems and speech. It's not mediated by practices and values and situations and histories. The postmodern is always going to be critical of that. So how shall then evangelical thinkers respond to the postmodern? Well, I was privileged to be part of a conference for summer faculty conference at Calvin on postmodern philosophy in 1996, led by Merrill Westfall. And then there was a special issue on postmodernity in the Christian Scholars Review. I don't know if you guys know what that is, but it's put out by Christian scholars. It's an interdisciplinary review seeking Christian learning, Christian scholarship. And Merrill had some interesting typologies there of responses. I'm borrowing a little bit from him, but he used the word ostrich. Okay, one way of responding to the postmodern is stick your head in the sand and hope it'll go away. All these obscure philosophers and all these ideas and all this weird language, couldn't we just, go have a beer and hope when we come back it'll be gone? No, it actually doesn't work that way. I mean, not everyone thinks we're living in a postmodern world, But I think the reason they don't think that is they think postmodern is the opposite of or something that comes totally after the modern. But when you realize it's something that is different from and feeds off of the modern and tries to do something radically different and new, then you see, well, there's postmodern things all over the place. The idea that we can just bury our head in the sand and hope it'll go away is not going to work for the church, because it's here, and it's here to stay, and not just in philosophy either. So the next approach is, among evangelicals, is what I will call an apologetic fortress. So, you know, you get this fortress mentality where, okay, those postmodern bad guys are out there with all their evil relativism, and we're going to stand on rock-solid biblical truth, and we're going to lob, you know, weapons over there and try to take them down and show how they're no good. And I actually have people I respect in life who I would put in here. That's the way they approach the postmodern is, you know, let's just be more rational, more logical, more analytical, and let's, you know, just laugh at the absurdity of someone like Richard Rorty, or who's probably America's most famous postmodern philosopher. And he passed away recently, but even still, people haven't always learned that he died. Interesting thing about Rorty is when he went postmodern, he left his philosophy job and went into literature. So first he was a professor of literature at Virginia, then at Stanford. Because you know, philosophy departments are dominated by the sort of hard-nosed, analytic, you know, symbolic logic, philosophy of science kind of departments, and he just did not fit in. English department is another story. So that's one way. I don't think this is helpful because it doesn't actually engage and learn from the other. And, you know, I've been reading Postmodern Thinking long enough, or the Gospels, take your pick, because you get the same lesson, that learning from and loving someone different from you is part of what we're called to do as Christians. So I don't think we can just say, well, you know, let's go back to business as usual and not even bother to engage to the level where we have listened to and learned from a different point of view that's not my own. So I'm not saying that all of this work is terrible, horrible, and evil, but I think it's very incomplete and somewhat rigid. Then there's my friends, also Christian philosophers, who love everything postmodern. And so I'm calling these the Pomo disciples. You know, they just embrace it, they love it, they eat it, it oozes out of their pores. And they try to turn Derrida into Saint Jacques or something like that. So, and he could do no wrong. You know, I mean, literally, there's no critique in their books of the postmodern. It's just expounding, and don't you get the point, and how can you not see that this is what they're saying all along, and how can you have such a simplistic analysis? And so there's really no critique. So this is the opposite problem, isn't it, from the fortress mentality is, here, you know, you just embrace it, love it, live it, and it's true that postmodern philosophy can be compatible with faith. Absolutely true. Especially when you realize it isn't just some simplistic form of relativism or whatever, but it's always playing at the spaces in between the text of our systems of ideas and so forth. And, you know, God can't be captured in human logic, so I don't have a problem with that. But not to have any critique, I have a problem with that. Not to realize there's limits to any system, including that of your favorite philosopher. Yeah, I have a little trouble with that. So the Pomo discipleship is there. It's a much smaller voice, by the way, among evangelicals. Teeny, tiny little minority. It's there. But it's not real big. And Roman Catholics, too, I've met a couple like that. But there's not too many. But still it's there, so I put up on my little simplistic, overly simplistic, already deconstructing itself typology, okay? So then I go to Missionary Encounter, which you know I was going to go there anyway. Have you ever noticed that in typologies, the last one is always the good one? It's like, you know, this is where, you know, so these are just leading up to, even in Christ and Culture back there by Reinhold Niebuhr, it's clear he really wants you to be Christ the Transformer of Culture. I mean, that's where he's comfortable, that's where he's going. Typologists are always like, they're rhetorical devices. So I'm trying to say, don't you really want to be that missionary encounter, you evangelical scholar? Okay. So here I think we have to look a little bit more at Leslie Newbegin. And he was a bishop, a theologian, a missionary leader, and I think many people agree that he was very important in India. I mean, he is a bishop of the Church of South India, the first one, which is an ecumenical church formed by a number of different denominations. But when he came back with India, he had this idea where now, how is the gospel going to encounter this Western culture with its values and philosophies, just as the gospel had to encounter Indian culture, learn from it, but also critique it. And so he has these books, again, that are on the book table, which this was a sign that really everything is predetermined from the foundation of the world, because I had no idea the books would be on the book table, but I put them up there anyway. So, Foolishness to the Greek, really that is a great little book on the gospel's encounter with contemporary culture, including scientism, and then Truth to Tell, the gospel's public truth. Again, that's a fabulous. They're both little books. They're really good. And the basic point Newbegin wants to make is, in every culture, including European culture, the gospel is going to criticize, learn from, in a missionary way, you know, listen, learn from, try to understand, but also be critical of. And why? Because no culture is the kingdom of God. No human culture is the city of God. The city of God is God's. And so it's not going to be something that we are going to identify with any nation. Yeah. United States, not the city of God. I know some of those Puritans wanted to build the city on the hill. It didn't work out. So no nation, no culture, no language is special and holy and more sacred than any other. And what that means, then, is every culture is open to criticism from the perspective of Jesus Christ. Well, then, what does this mean for what we've been talking about today, namely faith, science, the postmodern, and how the different disciplines can work together to help create a Christian worldview? Well, one of the things is, if we apply the missionary model, we're going to say science and rationality are not the gospel. They're important. They're useful. We don't want to be unscientific. We don't want to be irrational. They're not the same thing as the good news. I believe they're compatible with them. But it would be wrong to say, let's put all of our faith in science and human reasoning systems and hope that they will save us. That's just creating another kind of idol of the mind. Okay, and here I am going to quote Francis Bacon, this time with approval. There are idols of the mind that are problems and that get in the way of our development. Human flourishing. I hope we have a conference on alien flourishing after the one on human flourishing. Now, the other thing is that you don't have to read a lot of postmodern philosophy to realize there's real excesses to postmodern thinking. I mean, Derrida might be one of the worst. Foucault is almost as bad. Where they're just saying these outrageous things that you just go, I'm sorry, there's absolutely no prayer of that being even close to right. But it's, if you think of them as sometimes they're not making an argument, they're gesturing towards something they want you to feel almost, and you realize it's not the same thing as an analytic philosophy book, then you can kind of come to accept their playfulness. There's a lot of playing going on. Because they're making gestures, they're trying to get us to see things in a new way. They're not usually making long, strong arguments that if you took analytic philosophy in undergraduate college or graduate school, that's not the kind of way they write. That's not what they do. Because they're being critical of the postmodern, because the postmodern is critical of the modern, it cannot adopt all the style and language of the modern. It has to do something different. And what it does different is this sort of rhetorical excess. Well, after a while, that gets really boring and almost silly. One of the things I said in the seminar that made Merrill crack up was, you know, postmodern philosophy is, imagine your modern philosophy and you're really cramped up and everything. Well, postmodernity is kind of like X-lax. You know, a little bit is good when you need it, but you don't want to eat it all the time. And, you know, if you need that and you're all, you know, you got to let go a little, fine, have some. But, you know, you don't want to have this all day. So that would be bad. So he kind of agreed that there might be some reality in that. So if you do nothing but read these people, pretty soon it really warps your head. But they have a point, I think, that we can learn from. Points about the limitations of human language and rationality and systems of reasoning, whether it's symbolic logic, mathematics, physics and biology, or history and sociology. So both science and rationality and postmodern thought can be useful when properly engaged, understood, and criticized from the perspective of evangelical teaching based on the Word of God. So I want to say that again, because I think that's kind of the summary of what I'm trying to say, that whether we're talking about the sciences or postmodern thought, we need to first of all engage. That is, understanding is the first act. I have to tell this to my students all the time. You don't criticize someone until you understand them. You know, that sort of knee-jerk reaction that sometimes happens, especially if you're sure you already know the right theology, that can actually limit your own intellectual growth. So to engage, listening is the first thing we need to do. To understand and then also criticize. I'm not saying there shouldn't be a critical moment. There has to be a critical moment, because the Word of God is going to encounter all human cultures, and all human cultures are built by, guess what, sinful human beings just like you and me. So there's going to be problems there in all human cultural systems. They need to be criticized. But we also should remember, too, as you were saying earlier, that means my own favorite reading of the Bible and my own theology may be wrong. Because it, too, is a human system. It, too, is a human language. It, too, is a construct. And so I have to be open to being counter-critique from the voice of the other. I think that's something that's important to learn from postmodern authors. And postmodern critique, then, can help evangelicals overcome Enlightenment positions that are fundamentally against the gospel. And I would put in there things like evidentialism, namely that all belief must be based upon a proper amount of evidence. Scientism, we talked about that. And what Wolkersdorf and Plantinga have criticized as classical foundationalism. This is the idea that it's basically a version of evidentialism. All knowledge has to be based, finally, you know, through logical systems and schemes to certain basic beliefs that are self-evidential or evident to the reason or clear and evident or, you know, self-evident or something like that. And that's a problem for faith, because Christian faith usually doesn't fit those rationalist definitions of what's a proper basic belief. So you have to be critical of classical foundationalism in Christian philosophy, and I think they legitimately have done that. And I don't want to say classical foundationalism is dead in philosophy, because nothing in philosophy really dies, but it's on a respirator, and you know we're about to pull the plug. So I think that, you know, these positions are you know, if Al was here, he would shudder at the idea that he was postmodern. But my point is simply that kind of critique of Enlightenment pretensions is typical of the postmodern, even though Al himself is critical of postmodernism thinking. So I think the postmodern excesses have to be engaged and criticized. And to the extent that, for example, there might be moral relativism there, yeah, you have to criticize that. But for the most part, I don't see postmodern thinkers as being some kind of simple relativism. Usually that's not the case. They're often more sophisticated than that. Well, I think I've been talking long enough today, and you've been very patient with me, and I appreciate that. And I just tried to characterize in a very brief and, I hope, understandable way what are some of the things that are going on in postmodern philosophy. I haven't mentioned many names or works. I've just tried to say, you know, it's a long road. If you really want to get into this, you need to read some serious books that introduce postmodern thinking. But to just characterize some of these ideas to give you a handle on how we might think about not only Christian faith engaging natural science, but also Christian faith engaging postmodern philosophy. So now, you know, we'll turn it over to you and we'll have our discussion time. for the time that we have left. Thanks. Terry, you want to come up again and give that rebuttal you were talking about?
Question. I'm thinking about church people that I know and you know who are basically modernist in their worldview.
Yeah.
And their understanding of the faith is enlightenment based in some ways. How pastorally do you challenge that and help them to find another way of looking at it without... if there's no certainty
right.
you believe you can get to by reason, et cetera, and a whole school of Christian apologetics would point out, how do you pastorally help people to take a step away from that and go another direction?
Well, I would say that, when you're having these kinds of serious talk, obviously it's usually not at the coffee time right after the sermon or anything like that, but when there are times in adult forums or education times or afterwards when you're just talking to people's houses and these things come up, I really think that I usually go back, this is going to sound very strange, to the Bible. And I talk about the Bible's emphasis on faith. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of understanding, that you love God. And that faith and love are just not the same thing as rationality. And can they imagine a person who loved God and had faith, but had some doubts and wasn't so absolutely certain about the capital T truth? And I think basically all I'm usually interested in doing is really not changing their mind so much as allowing that another person could be a faithful disciple of Jesus, could have the Holy Spirit, could take the Bible seriously, could read a lot and think a lot, and not be in the same place they're at. And, just to get that, I think, is important, because it's so easy to believe my system, my philosophy, my way is the Christian way, or the best, only right Christian way, or something like that. So usually that's the move I try to make. And it's just, the scriptures are not a rationalist document. They just aren't. So it is not hard to point out that, following Jesus in the way of the cross is not the same thing as creating the ontological argument now. It doesn't mean you don't love St. Anselm. He's a great guy. For him, it came in a prayer, his life of prayer. But it's just not the same thing. So that's usually where I go.
Thank you.
Yes.
So, maybe it's because I'm in the science department, that I think one thing you said, that postmodernism is not throwing out modernism.
Yeah.
Kind of the hyper-positivism from science.
Right.
Now, it seems like the average kind of uninformed student's mindset is that science provides a certainty within its realm, and we can bank on that, and it's really useful technologically and all of that. But anything goes in soft areas.
Oh, yeah,
so
hard science and soft.
I construct my own meaning by myself, for myself.
Right.
And it's unassailable. So, I was at a discussion at Chadbourne Hall, which is just right over here, where we were all supposed to come in and talk about Richard Dawkins' The God Delusion book.
Okay.
It's an interesting experience, because one of the students in my little discussion group said, well, we're supposed to rank ourselves on Dawkins' scale. He has a theism to atheism scale, one being a completely convinced theist that nothing on earth would shake your confidence in God's existence, and seven is a complete atheist.
And Dawkins number of perfection.
Right. Dawkins puts himself at a six, and one of the women at my discussion table said, well, I'm a six as well. And then we started talking about, for Dawkins, evidence seems to be really important, and she said, well, I don't really need any evidence. I just know that God doesn't exist, and that's enough for me.
Yeah, that's a statement of faith.
That was literally the extent of her thinking about the subject.
Yeah.
So, right, that's sort of creating your own reality in a way. And how do you deal with that practically? So,
I think practically, you need to... Both of those statements are incorrect. On the one hand, they're helping them to see through the evils of science study. Philosophy of science, history of science, sociology of knowledge, that science is not this absolute bedrock of certainty. It yields truth. But truth comes to us mediated through human systems. And then if you can get them to see that, which is sometimes hard, I think, but if you look at historical examples, that helps, I think. Then it doesn't seem so strange that truth in other domains might come to us through humanly mediated systems. So it's not like the idea that either it's absolutely true or it's a social construct is just a simplistic bifurcation. Neither one of them is true to either science or the humanities. All truth comes to us through some mediated system that we had a hand in creating, whether it's a specific language, whether it's a mathematics, whether it's the tools of science, whether it's art or poetry. I mean, we had a hand in creating almost all the modes by which the truth comes to us, except for basic, you know, five senses kind of experience of the world. So, I don't know. I mean, you don't want to have them think science is not true. I mean, that clearly is would be inaccurate.
So that one, I think, is easier to deal with, probably. It's the other one. It's almost solipsism in a way, right? So what do you do with that? I mean, and I think we're seeing students coming out of university that are more of them are like that.
Yeah, I agree. More of them are like that sort of individualistic, world-creating.
Kind of, it's my own blogosphere. You know, that's
Yeah, I think it's kind of, sometimes that's a hard nut to crack, and the way to get at it, I think, is, you know, in terms of person-to-person evangelism is, you know, what are they passionate about? What are they really sure about? It, maybe it's, you know, the Olympic Games in China, or maybe it's ecological ethics, or maybe it's gender rights, or, you know, and then start probing that a little bit. Now, is this just like okay for you? It's okay for me to have slavery over here as long as it's, you know, but you don't like slavery? I mean, so that usually what happens is people have these incredible moral prejudices that they just assume without thinking are absolutely true. And it's just only a horrid, evil, benighted swab would dare think otherwise, but as soon as you start probing that, then you start helping them to realize they do have some principles that are not based on science that they really think are true, and a lot of that has to do with the individual. Now, the worst thing that would happen was then to give those up, right? What you're trying to get them to see is there's domains of truth that are outside of science. And I would usually go with whatever they're the most really involved in. You know, their things, that their worldview, their philosophy of life that makes them tick. And maybe there's a chance there of getting them out of that sort of person relativism, this sort of fallback for so many people. Even Derrida, for example, says justice cannot be deconstructed in a famous lecture he gave at a law school in New York. So, I mean, people have these passions where they realize this can't be. Systems of justice can be deconstructed, Derrida thinks, but justice cannot be. So it's a transcendental. If you can find things that people really are committed to, you get to some truth that they're willing to accept. But we are living in a very relativistic culture. There's no question about it. And to that extent, I think it's somewhat postmodern. Well, if I stun you in the silence, that happens sometimes. You know. My wife falls asleep all the time.
I'm asking too many questions, I guess. But, I get the sense, you mentioned apologetics apologetic fortress.
Yeah, I'm not against apologetics, but you know what I'm saying.
But I think one implicit assumption in that model is that if we have a defeater for postmodernism,
then we're good.
Game over. I win. No, because there are incipient postmodern areas of thinking that escape the defeaters and nevertheless infiltrate culture, right? So,
well, and maybe there's something we can learn from these postmodern bad guys that we're attacking that might be important.
The other piece of it, but, you know, when you're... To what extent do you think postmodernism as a kind of intellectual movement is... it seems like that's old hat in the academy in some ways.
It is.
What
it is.
What you're really addressing is the kind of the percolation effect.
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
The academy's moved on from postmodernism, haven't they?
There's nowhere to move, unless you want to go back to modernity. Like I said, it's not like there's something that's coming after the postmodern. But it's
pre-modern, yeah.
Pre-modern, maybe. No, well, I think the people that are the most seeped in it, that got trained in all of this in the 60s and 70s, have tended to go back to their traditions in a new way. There's nowhere else to go. It's not like, okay, now I'm going to do something totally different that's not chemistry or history or sociology or psychology or philosophy. You're still going to do English criticism or whatever. You're just going to try to do it in a new way that maybe avoids some of the problems of the past. So there really isn't anything after it. It's just, you know, it's a critique. It's not a time or a space you can really stand in for very long.
Can postmodern, dare you criticize modernism on specific things? I mean, criticize the excesses of postmodernism.
Yes.
Is postmodernism or postmodern thinking not leave itself any targets that you're willing to actually directly address? Or
I mean, what are some of the excesses?
I know you mentioned excesses, but.
Well, you want to know what they are?
No. When you say postmodern excesses, are you saying that there's sort of a moderate postmodernism that is wholly good, that doesn't need critique, or?
Well, I think what I'd say is maybe there's a moderate way of going back to our disciplines of inquiry that learned from those critiques and doesn't make the same kind of mistakes. It's still going to make mistakes, but not those kinds. You know. And then, like I said, you can't live in the postmodern moment. It's too much of a critique. It feeds off of other... Derrida cannot write a book. He can only write a book about other people's books. Even when he's supposed to give a talk about himself, he has someone else write about himself, and then he writes at the bottom his critique of what someone said about him. Because he cannot write about himself, because then he had to write in his own voice. He can't do that. So I'm just saying that you can't stand in the postmodern that long. You can do it for a while, but you go back to doing what you loved before, hopefully without making the same mistakes. And I see that's what's happening in the disciplines that have engaged. So it's not like postmodern is old hat. It's just they saw, okay, these were problems, and then they've come back to it again. And I don't know if there's a name for that. I think it's just sort of keep on muddling through, the English would call it. So, but there are definite problems in postmodern philosophy. But to answer exactly what they are, you have to go to the specific figures, you know, that we are. And I've tried to avoid that, talking sort of generalities that are pretty vague. So. I don't know if that helps you or not. But. Yes.
I wonder if postmodernism isn't kind of like the multi-headed hydra, and you know, you chop a head off, and then there are all these new heads that emerge, because it does seem to me it finds all kinds of different and varying expression within all the disciplines. And then, because there's business people who talk about postmodernism, there's postmodern architecture, there's artists,
right.
They happen at different times and different moments and mm-hmm. different places and different cities, and mm-hmm. The more the disciplines subdivide and have their areas of specialness, and almost by nature it is that kind of elusive.
Well, that's why there's no such thing as postmodernism. I mean, I always distrust people who talk about postmodernism, because there ain't no such thing.
Right.
There's an attitude, a gesture, a way of responding to modernity that has no ism to it, has no core, no essence, no... And it's always a critique in response to the modern. And then, okay, what is it? Is it modern art, modern architecture, the modern novel? You know, and so there were all these different ways of making the postmodern turn, right?
It's more like it's in the water.
It's not an ism.
You can keep adding water to it, but there's still traces of it in the water.
Maybe. I mean, I don't know if I... I'm not sure I really understand what you're trying to say there, but... I think that my point would be, instead of ignoring it and hoping it'll go away, or just seeing it as the devil or the bad guy or the monster that we have to slay or kill, let's see in postmodern moves in our disciplines something important that we can learn from and respond to, and also realize as Christians, postmodernity is not in and of itself a stance that can last for long. You know, it can't be by itself. It has to always be with an other, and that other tends to be modernity. But Christianity is not married to modernity. It's not like Christianity is an Enlightenment religion or some kind of rationalism or some romantic seeking after the immediacy of the sublime, you know, the soul and God contemplating one another for eternity or something. It's none of those things, right? But neither is Christianity wedded to any kind of postmodern critique of those things. So that Christianity as a religion is actually in an interesting place where we can see the good and bad in both and use them both for God's glory without having to worry about, gee, am I being postmodern enough? Or, gee, am I being rationalist enough? Or, you know what I'm saying? There's things we can learn from them, both types. And I don't want us to fall into the trap of being both completely as Christian intellectuals. That's kind of what I'm saying. So I don't know if there's a moderate postmodernism that's beyond all critique. I don't think anything's beyond all critique, but there's a moderating viewpoints that learn from modernity and postmodernity. And the people, I will give you some names now. The people that I like that I think do that well are people like Paul Ricoeur, who was a French Christian philosopher and who taught both at the University of Paris and at Chicago. People like the Catholic thinker Alistair MacIntyre would be another one who has written this wonderful book on three types of moral inquiry, where he's critical of what he calls the encyclopedia, that's the rationalist. He's critical of genealogy, which is basically Nietzsche. And his hero is, of all people, Thomas Aquinas. He's just going, what? But it's a very interesting book. It's about that big. So there are these people who engage and know the postmodern and come away without being either, they're neither encyclopedia nor genealogy. It's something else. And sometimes it is by going back to older sources that have been ignored or older voices that have been overlooked. I mean, sometimes that can happen. So I think there are people that do a good job of mediating the turn without falling into either ditch of modernity or post, you know, extremes of postmodernism. You know, postmodernism. Yes, Jeff.
Two observations. One is, in an interesting way, if we understand the sort of play of postmodernity, I mean, the way it sort of creates these insights.
Yeah.
I mean, one thing that's at work there is sort of a play of getting at new truths about the world.
They wouldn't put it that way, but I agree with you. I agree with you.
You know, it's sort
but
of...
They would never go there, but I agree
that.
With you.
Small,
I agree with you.
Small team,
yeah.
So in that sense, I don't think we have to be as... I mean, when you put up the fortress model, I was thinking, that's something that needs deconstructing.
Absolutely.
And so, you know,
actually, the whole right. model I use is too simplistic, but yeah.
But if you take a stance that way, I think it's helpful. I think another observation, and this comes right out of MacIntyre's work, I do a lot with MacIntyre.
MacIntyre is an enormously important
yes.
philosopher.
But out of his work in Three Rival Versions,
it's a good book.
There's a way in which he argued, I mean, in his nature of what should happen in the university in that last chapter, this is sort of a crass paraphrase, but he basically says, we need our enemies. I would put it in Christian language. We need our enemies. Because if we have people who don't think, if you're making a claim to truth and people don't agree with it, you don't have a classical definition of what we would say is true. And so you have to engage in a sort of dialectical encounter to try and understand why they disagree with you, as well as you need to try and understand them. And I think he gives us a sort of good motivation for trying to figure out how to engage mm-hmm. postmodernity and these rival perspectives as a way to get at what we need to articulate truth. And
right.
From this missional perspective, I think.
So truth is what happens when you engage differences of opinion and come out in a new space.
Right.
That incorporates the insights of both where you were before and what you learned from your other enemy.
Yeah. I mean, in a sense,
your opponent.
We can't get at the truth without them.
Correct.
And so in that sense.
I agree with that, though.
Well, I know.
Okay. That's why I'm a realist when it comes to theology and philosophy and science, but a dialectical realist, because I think you need multiple perspectives to get at the truth in exactly the way that Ricoeur makes the same move in ethics when he talks about oneself as another in his Gifford lectures. Or Gadamer makes the same truth talking about how do we interpret texts when he talks about the fusion of horizons around the text speaking to us. So there's a dialogical way. Reading is always a dialogue with the text where, you know, it's not like the text is there with some fixed meaning that just gets poured into your brain, but there's this open conversation with texts that happens over time. So different philosophers have made this kind of move, and I think it's fundamentally important to see dialogue as essential to humans coming to discover the truth. That's why I think Q&A is so important. Good learning.
I'll flip them too. I think we need to embrace that injunction that is throughout Scripture. Fear not.
Fear not.
I mean, I think.
Okay, I thought you were going to say, burn them to the ground and show them no mercy, but that's only for the book of Joshua. So. But yeah, fear not. Yeah, fear not. Yeah, that's right. Yes, John.
It's kind of related to that, especially the last comment about fearing not. I feel like this moment presents some good opportunities for Christian scholars in that.
Oh yeah.
I mean, there are the parts of the academy that can kind of keep going business as usual and doesn't need to let all of the stuff you've been talking about particularly affect their world. And then there are the parts where these kinds of critiques leave them without any kind of foundation.
Right.
No
ground to stand on, as it were.
So that you get certain academic superstars who basically, by the power of their rhetorical skills, create a foundation in words, but that can be flashy and really impressive, but at the end of the day, leaves people feeling somewhat unsatisfied. And if there's this sense that we've got to go forward, that we should be grateful for these critiques because they've really enlarged reason by helping reason to see its own limitations. And it's actually,
right.
I think, really remarkable that reason is able to see its own limitations. I think that's fantastic.
That is remarkable.
But then we need to be able to go forward knowing that we have all these intellectual limitations. We can't we can't have a solid foundation that's rational. And Christians, hopefully, are people who are used to proceeding constructively on the basis of a fundamental commitment that's not, at its root, rational.
Oh, it's not purely rational.
Right. In that sense, I think that we've got the potential to mm-hmm. be a little bit less blown around in this storm mm-hmm. than a lot of other people.
No, that's a very good comment, and I do agree with it. I think it goes back to what I was trying to say to Terry before, is I usually go back to the Bible because the Bible itself is neither modern nor postmodern. It's not a rationalist document. And in the idea that Christ calls us and we respond in faith and in a life of discipleship, we have a model for going forward in our disciplines that doesn't require the sort of self-grounding absolute system, but that's willing to take a step and to realize there are things you can trust in, even if you can't prove it beyond the shadow of a doubt. Well, thank you again for being with me. I enjoyed this very much.
Thank you.